For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dory Smith. As America passed the one-year anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, millions of people demonstrated in cities all over the world. Today we take a look at another anniversary, passed on March 1, 1954, a day when weapons of mass destruction were used. They were tested by America in what was to become an international nightmare called Operation Bravo off the Marshall Islands. It was the first time the H-bomb had been tested, but America would perform 67 atomic tests in the Marshall Islands, ultimately paying reparations to the thousands of people they irradiated in the process. For many years, the inhabitants of the Marshall Islands were used as unvolunteer guinea pigs on tests, and then they were studied about in the aftermath of the USA nuclear bomb researches. Joining us to talk about this today is Steve Osborne. He is a freelance writer and atomic veteran who witnessed Operation Red Wing off Bikini Atoll in 1956. I asked this former newspaper man and member of Poets Against the War to start today's program with one of his poems about the Marshall Islands tests called The Day of Two Sunrises.
Okay, well, they had a memorial on the 50th anniversary of the Bravo test, which was that was in 54, and my tests were in 56. And the Bravo test was a huge nuclear blast. It was a hydrogen bomb of about 15 megaton power, which is an unbelievable amount. I think the Hiroshima bomb was about 20,000 tons. This is the equivalent of 15 million tons of TNT going off. And it was on an atoll. It was a surface burst right on the reef. And it blew a huge crater and just literally vaporized, I forget what the cubic mileage of it is, but it was a couple of miles across and 600 feet deep, something like that. This huge divot cut out, and all that water and coral and so forth was vaporized and went up with the cloud and drifted downwind and then fell out looking somewhat like snow on the Rongelapis and on another island, a bunch of islanders downwind, and also on a Japanese fishing boat named Lucky Dragon, which got them all sick, and they lost one person. And the Lucky Dragon is I believe now is a museum in Japan. But I wrote a poem in memory of the Bravo test, which I called The Day of Two Sunrises. And it was sort of funny because I was communicating with Marcia Joyner, who had set up the Bocce site, which is about the nuclear tests and so forth. And I had a dream, and this sort of figured in it. I woke up and I wrote this poem. The Day of Two Sunrises. My brother and I went to play by the boats pulled up on the beach. We raced and played tag and chased land crabs in the pre-dawn light. The sun began to light the east as it always had before. Suddenly, a second sun arose in the west where never the sun had risen. We ran to Mama to ask her what and why. She did not know, and the new sun died as quickly as it grew. In the men's house, they talked and remembered. The day began as always, the men to fish in their outriggers, the mothers cooking and digging taro, gathering plantains and watching over the children, who played at fishing and gathering and ran and played tag. Suddenly from the sky fell white powder. Once a missionary had told of snow. Perhaps this was snow. It came down covering everything. It was sticky. We played and scooped it up and threw it at each other. It was fun. That evening, I did not feel so well. My eyes hurt, and my stomach turned to water. My brother's body was covered with blisters, and his skin began to fall off. Mother was vomiting, too, and her beautiful hair began to come out in hands full. Mother wondered if it was the snow, so she washed us, but the water was filled with snow, and the scrubbing removed the skin. Soon the whole village was sick, and the animals and the plants all were sick. After 2 days, the strange men came in boats with a large mouth which dropped open on the beach, and white-clad creatures came out. They wore masks with strange eyes and a long, round mouth. They pointed sticks at us, which buzzed and crackled. They pointed the sticks at everything, the trees, the wells, the fish, and listened to the buzz and crackle, then made marks on little boards they carried. Finally, they left, but told us we were very sick, and not to eat of the fish, the coconuts, the plantains, the taro, that they were now taboo. The men returned in their large boats and said our island was now taboo. They gathered us up, leaving everything behind. We were taken to another place where we were poked and bled. We looked so terrible that the people must have been afraid. They wore the strange white suits when they looked in on us. My brother looked the worst, like an old man with scabs, which broke and bled and his teeth fell out, and then he was dead. Mama became an old woman with patchy hair and always a sickness. Each time she saw me, she cried. I was so sick, so tired, and then one day I died.
The Day of Two Sunrises. Steve Osborne joins us. He's a poet against the war, contributes to the website Poets Against the War, and to others through the Atomic Veterans. These are U.S. military personnel who were in the ships off Bikini Atoll and the Marshall Islands during the various tests that went on there, 67 of them. Steve, let's talk about the importance of that March 1st anniversary to you.
Well, there were a number of things about it because, you know, Bikini and the test series have virtually faded from everybody's memory now, and I've noticed in forums that people take a ho-hum attitude about it. Well, it was a long time ago, and well, it was just a little island out in the Pacific Ocean of no importance. So, you know, we've got bigger and better things to worry about now. And in the meantime, the public policy has taken less and less care of the people who were dispossessed, who lost their homes and their islands. Their islands are still uninhabitable. And the other thing is that they're just guinea pigs. And under the Freedom of Information Act, there's been information released about, you know, how they were tested and retested. And apparently, the plan for a study was made a year before Bravo, which makes the accident of Bravo somewhat suspect. If they were planning a year before to set up both control groups and exposed groups a year before the test, then that to me means that the claim that Bravo was bigger than they expected and that the winds changed at the last minute, which they did not, they knew where the winds were blowing, is, you know, typical governmental horse feathers. So to me, the entire test series, you know, when you fired one of those damn things off once, okay, they work, they're terrible, let it go at that. I don't see the need for continued testing and continued development. But I'm just one voice in the wilderness.
Let's launch right from there into our discussion about Iraq, because I know you've been keeping right up with the war and are quite concerned, as are other veterans, about the use of depleted uranium and the impact on both the Iraqi people and the U.S. military. When you think about the tests that were done in the 50s and 60s and the impact on the people of the Marshall Islands, talk a little bit about how that information being available is so stark as evidence that what we're doing right now in our tests and in our use of weapons like using depleted uranium is so starkly wrong.
Well, to me, as far as depleted uranium is concerned, you know, I've talked with people, and they say, "Oh, well, it's low-level radiation; it can't hurt you. There's no problem with it. Why? The background radiation is higher than what you get from a block of depleted uranium, so you don't have to worry about it." And the thing that interests me is, number one, apparently the people that work with depleted uranium, making munitions, have to wear respirators and protective clothing at all times, which doesn't sound too like it's too harmless. And what happens with the depleted uranium, it's incredibly dense. very an extremely dense substance, hard, heavy substance. And when it's fired, it tends to vaporize and fragment, and it'll punch a hole through the thickest armor that you find in a tank or anything else, I guess, and incinerate the people inside for the most part. But what you also have then is that this depleted uranium, which does not go away, this isn't something that's biodegradable. It's there. It's got a half-life of, I believe it's either 4.5 billion years, which means that in 4.5 billion years it'll be half as radioactive as it is now. And so you've got this dust scattered around, and we've fired hundreds of tons of depleted uranium munitions. And you've got all of this dust and fragments laying around that can be stirred up, and you can breathe it in. And when you breathe it in, then you have a little low-level emitter in your lung that's going to be transmitting a small amount of radiation into the surrounding cells. And the chances of developing a cancer from that, I would say, are significantly higher than not having it in your lungs. So when they start talking about, well, it's harmless, that's like Agent Orange was harmless. In GovSpeak, everything that that we do that screws people up, there's nothing to it, it's all in your mind. The only problem is that down the road, we find out that it's also in the body.
And one has to ask then, are the Iraqi people, the U.S. military personnel, going through something much like what people poisoned by Castle Bravo went through, the Rongelapalese, the U.S. military personnel then? Is this similar to you, and in what way?
I was reading No Place to Hide, which is a book that was written a few years after the original Bikini Operation Crossroads tests, and one of his functions was to fly over the radiation, the areas of the bomb where the bombs went off, and they'd fly over in decreasing circles and get the level of radioactivity. And the ground burst, or the water burst, which was the second one, Bravo shot, they flew over that, and his machinery went off the scale. He says, get out of here. They flew back until they were in a safe level. But they tried flying back and forth over the blast area, and they had humongous radiation. And that didn't last very long. It was, a few days or a week later, why the radiation level had dropped considerably. But the lingering stuff is, that's what does a lot of damage, because even when I was there in 56, we were all a bunch of young kids, and when we went on Liberty, on Nan Island, the word was that we were not to eat any of the coconuts or anything that we found, growing on the island. And, of course, most of us sneaked a coconut or two because, put a bunch of teenagers on a tropical island, what are they going to do? They're going to go sneak a coconut. But apparently, the cesium-90 and strontium and so forth is in the topsoil, and that gets absorbed by the plants and comes out and is in the fruit. So the higher you are in the food chain, the more radioactive everything, the cumulative radioactivity is there. The people, when they were brought back to Bikini to live some years after the test, they moved them back to Bikini, but they told them, don't eat anything. Don't eat the fish. Don't eat anything that's growing, subsist on canned goods. And then later on, they took them off the island because I guess they were having problems of some sort, whether it was, I haven't read that deeply into it. I can't read those tests. I just can't. Just thinking about it now chokes me up. To read, governmentese of the number, kind of regretting the fact that their control groups weren't accurate enough to be absolutely certain they were right in testing the mortality of these exposed groups, and cold-bloodedly saying, if we had a better laboratory setup, we'd be able to tell, but now we can just estimate from the fact how many stillborns or how many few are born than would normally be born in a population of that size. And, you know, so it's, well, we'll watch them, and if they're not having many kids, that means that there's a lot of problems. And if they're having a lot of malformed children and so forth, then that's a problem. And we'll just statistically analyze it. And unfortunately, I can't do that because I keep putting myself in the place of the poor beggars that are over there as the testees. And like I say, I'm sorry, I just can't read it. So I don't have my statistics exact.
The Rongelapalese were moved, as you were saying, from one island to the next. And a lot of people don't even know who they are and what happened to them. They were in proximity to some of the first U.S. nuclear tests, and these were big bombs. And you've written alongside of your poem, in memory of the Rongelapalese and other islanders poisoned by Castle Bravo, March 1, 1954, 15 megatons dropped on a region of the world populated by people. One has to ask who could have done such a thing? Why? What's the fallout in terms of policies that would prohibit this kind of atrocity from taking place again?
Well, after working for many, many years, we had the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Missile Reduction Treaty and so forth, which I, for one, breathed a great sigh of relief because I figured it was a step in the right direction. And we had had a treaty with the then Soviet Union, which would reduce our nuclear weapon arsenals on both sides, and that these weapons would be destroyed, they wouldn't be stored. And so little by little, we'd get rid of that. Now, all that was doing really was removing overkill, because both sides had enough nuclear weaponry to blow up the world 1,000 times or more. But it was a step in the right direction. And so Bush's business of bully-ragging everybody into destroying these treaties. So now the treaty reads that the weapons will be placed in storage. Well, if you've got weapons placed in storage and you've got ill-paid guards, then the chances of these weapons being bribed out of storage is a lot greater than if these warheads and so forth were disassembled, destroyed, and hopefully the radioactive elements were buried or sequestered some way or other so that that's off the scope.
Now, what happened to people like yourself as a consequence of those tests? What kinds of things have the atomic veterans all gone through together, Steve Osborne?
Well, I can't speak for everybody. I know I spent an awful lot of nightmare time after my time over there, and I would have this dream. I used to live in San Francisco and in Sausalito, and I would have this recurring dream where I was down on the beach, on Ocean Beach, with the kids or just down there and so forth, and then I would see this string of bombs going off upwind of us and know that somebody had finally unleashed a cobalt bomb or something, and we'd all had it, and I'd wake up, in tears and shaking. And that finally faded away. And then, as you've probably read on my nuclear vet site offerings there, the burned hand teaches twice about fire and there must be no day. I'd finally gotten this pretty well put behind me until they had the film called The Day After. And then I flashed back when they started launching the missiles because I knew what was going to happen. And I really came apart. I thought I had it behind me, but I didn't. I imagine that a lot of the guys are the same way. I've corresponded with a number of guys that were on my ship and that I'd been out of touch with, and they all say it's pretty much as my reminiscence. They said I hit it right on the button, and so I imagine that they've had essentially the same reactions.
Now, a lot of you are active and opposing the war in Iraq and seeing it as a grave risk, not just because of what's happened to the Iraqi people and to the Americans and others that are there in the war zone, but also a grave risk to the world. Talk a little bit about your views on what this war and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan mean.
Well, to me, sadly enough, it means that the United States is no longer a nation of laws, a nation that believes in laws and international treaties and so forth. We have unilaterally or through economic blackmail managed to dismantle anything that's inconvenient to the United States, things like the War Crimes Tribunal and so forth. We're so afraid of War Crimes Tribunal because they say some of our people could be tried. Well, if we're guilty of war crimes, we should be tried. And the nuclear treaties, the peaceful uses of space treaty, that's going to be the next one that's going to go. And because the United States is determined to have a weapons arsenal in space where they can take out anybody else's satellites if they don't do or broadcast what we tell them to, they've gotten very frustrated with the fact that some of the European satellites have broadcast things that the United States did not want broadcast. And so the latest thing is, well, we'll either scramble them or zap them. And that seems to be our new empire's motto, scramble them or zap them. You know, if somebody doesn't agree with us, we'll zap them. And some of the high-energy weapons that they're working on and so forth, if they get that developed and they can work from space, why, they could sit there and from space they could blow up a car or blow up a Capitol building, say, okay, now do what you're told. Next time we'll hit your Senate. You know, it's to me, it's not the function of the United States, which was founded with a constitution, which I think is one of the greatest things ever written. And it now seems to be being considered just a obsolete old parchment which should be gotten out of the way so that they can get on to modern times. And modern times seems to be following in the footsteps of Hitler and Mussolini, frankly. And it makes me very sad.
We talked a little bit about this before, Steve, but what about the reasons that the American people are buying any of the reasons given for this war? Why are they, if they are, buying it? How is that working?
Well, I don't know if there are many people around, especially younger than me, that remember Goebbels and remember what went on in Nazi Germany. But Goebbels said, if you tell a lie, and the lie is big enough, and you repeat it often enough, it becomes the truth. And we have a virtual propaganda ministry in the United States, sadly enough, because the press has rolled over and played dead for the most part, and you know, the big newspapers, the television outfits, and so forth—they're the big monopolies which are getting all kinds of grants and favorable contracts and this, that, and the other thing handed to them by the government. And obviously, the government says, you know, you tell the people what we want you to tell them, and you know, you can walk away with the store. And they're all buying it. They're all shaking hands and backslapping and having a good old time with it.
And then we have entertainment television and news stories endlessly about Martha Stewart. And it's amazing that even as we have seen a large increase in the number of terrorist attacks over the last 6 months worldwide, even in Iraq, now Spain, we've seen more in Iraq. Today happens to be March 17th that we're having this discussion, and we've seen another attack on a hotel in Baghdad. And it seems to be ratcheting up so high that one has to worry about this being an election year. What on earth are they going to do to shut the information down at this point?
Trying to do anything to distract us away from the real problems. Historically, you know, when times are troublous at home, and the economy's falling apart and so forth, then the government's main thing is to have a war on the outside. And that's why the Cold War worked so well, because there was them, you know, the Russian evil empire, and all sacrifices that were needed and were called for was to hold off the evil empire. And when Bush the First and his voodoo economics that Reagan and Bush the First came through were beginning to pay off with, you know, the greatest number of homeless that we'd ever had, and joblessness was increasing, and, you know, everything was just falling apart at home, and all of a sudden, by golly, we went to war with Iraq over Kuwait, and so everybody was distracted to that. I'm not sure what will happen here, whether Bush is going to decide to go after another country, which is not too unlikely. I'm sorry, but I am really suspicious of what these guys are going to do. If they were Pinocchio, their nose would span the Grand Canyon.
Steve Osborne is an atomic veteran. He saw the U.S. military test nuclear devices off the Marshall Islands, and I say was very much impacted by those tests, both physically and mentally and in every way. Steve, I would like you to share with us one of your other poems, and this is about war. And maybe you could dedicate this one to John Kerry and ask that he take it to heart and listen to you and hear your poem, The Last Question.
His last question. I answered my country's call and blitzkrieged across Iraq. The stench of burning flesh is seared into my brain. We were liberators, I was told, and would be greeted with joy. The misery and hate in their eyes is burned into my memory. The children sometimes smile but are quickly hurried away. Weapons fire rips through the street. My reflexes drop me to the dirt. Ambulances, bodies, civilians, children, sometimes a buddy of mine. Automatic weapons and RPGs do not pick and choose. My sergeant says don't trust any of them. Waste them if they get too close. A sick baby dead with its family asking for help. Despite this, I'm a liberator, or so I'm told. Explosions far and near disturb my rest. The pervading heat dehydrates me. Every man's hand is turned against me here, and I'm to continue liberating. It's tough at home, the president says. They've got to cut my pay. My tour's extended to a year. I've never seen my son. I've seen a lot of babies die and heard the women cry and seen my buddies blown apart by liberated men. I've tried to do my duty, but, Lord, it's getting hard. The war is over, the prez has said. Does he tell that to the body bags? I joined to get an education, agreed to do what I was told, was assured I'd be greeted with flowers and cheers and tears of joy. What I've seen smacks of madness. I'll never be the same. My life is one last question. May I go home now, please?
That was Steve Osborne reading his poem, His Last Question. And that was read in honor of John Kerry. I then asked Steve to tell us his final thoughts.
You know, when I was a kid, the Democratic Party built a platform, plank by plank, and each of these planks covered policies and problems and so forth. And so when this platform was built, your candidate stood, you know, four square on the platform and said, this is what I stand for and this is what I intend to accomplish. And I would like to see the Democratic Party put together a good platform of reform, tax reform, and this abyss of war that we're in. All of this stuff. Build a good platform and get Mr. Kerry to stand up there and say, "Hey, this is what I'm going to do. And if I can't do it, then I expect the American people to remove me and put in someone who can do it." And if he'll stand up and do that, I'll support wholeheartedly. Well, my final words on this is to end this insanity now and turn this country around, give us our Constitution back, and let us once again take leadership in the world, not dictatorship in the world. That's the main thing. We've got so much healing to do and so much to turn around that has gone wrong in this past 4 years. And I expect him to toe the mark and do that. And if he will do that, I will support him to the last ditch. If he won't, I have no idea where we're going to go.
Steve Osborne spends his time working for nuclear disarmament and world peace. You can read his poems on the website poetsagainstthewar.org. You can read his articles online at commondreams.org. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. If you would like to comment on today's program, write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.